You are listening to an entertainment program put together by a company called Financial Ineptitude. Anything said on this show is not an endorsement or professional advice. Would you really want to tell a court of law you were suing us because you thought taking financial advice from two idiots on a podcast put out by Financial Ineptitude was a good idea? Really? Clown hat, smiley face.
Financial Ineptitude presents Two Bulls in a China Shop. You can find our podcast at twobullsinachinashop.com or just search Two Bulls in a China Shop wherever you stream your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the China Shop. I'm opening the doors today. Oh, this is Shopkeeper Dan here. With me as always is Kyle, creator of financialineptitude.com. Hey, Kyle, you got anything clicky in your hand right now?
No. This is the third or fourth time we're trying to record this intro.
Oh, yeah. I keep picking things up and making stupid noises. Anyway, I'm doing fantastic. We got a crazy awesome interview for you today. But first, let's check in. How are you doing today, Kyle?
I'm fantastic. Still.
Still.
For the fourth time.
For the fourth time, Kyle's still doing fantastic. Well, I think we better just jump into it then.
Yes.
So let's introduce our guest. Folks, we are so super, super excited. We've got with us today Dan Legault from Antibes Therapeutics. How are you doing today, Dan?
Yeah, real pleasure to be joining you, one in Illinois, one in Arizona. Awfully exciting.
Been really excited about having you on the show, too. I got to say, we've been interacting with some of the investors on StockTwits, and oh my gosh, you guys have one heck of a knowledgeable group of investors there in the retail world.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's great. I correspond with a number of them. I sort of make it a point of pride of corresponding with anyone who emails me. We really do have a group of loyal shareholders, and we love them, of course.
Well, and that's in this modern era of investing, that's one of the things that catches my attention is the excitement level, because a lot of retail investing is changing where there's a lot more research available and a lot more people sharing their knowledge. So when there's excitement on social media that I come across from people who, when you talk to them, they're very informed, very informed. That's a good sign to me,
right.
and to know that the company themselves are reaching out and interacting right up to the CEO level. That's fantastic. That's fabulous.
Sounds like you actually set the trend before Aaron Adams from AMC did. I think he's been getting a lot of love for being on Twitter.
right. So Dan, tell us a little bit. Where does the name Antibes come from? Because I know you're a pharmaceutical company, and you know maybe I'm ignorant down here in the States, but Antibes doesn't evoke the feeling of medicine to me.
Right.
Yeah. No, we love the name. It's actually named after the town of Cap d'Antibes, the beautiful medieval town in the Mediterranean, right near Nice, between Nice and Monaco. It sort of juts in there. Now a bit of a jet set place, sort of a romantic name for a biotech company. But our founder and my longtime friend and our chief science officer, John Wallace, he was chairing the science board of advisors of an awfully cool French company, and that area really is the Silicon Valley of France. And so when he would go over there for a meeting, he would hang out in Cap d'Antibes and just fell in love with the place. I know it because I spent a lot of time in France, and it's just it's just adorable. And so he said, you know, he was onto the thing that we're on about. And so he said, I'm going to name the company after this beautiful, amazing place. And of course, we love the name.
Oh yeah,
it sounds a lot better than Oronto
or
Check Triel,
Check RX or something. Yeah.
Well, Dan, do you want to tell us a little bit about what your company does? The otenaproxisol, the hydrogen sulfide platform in general, like how you guys developed it, how that came into being, where that's going, the uses, all that kind of good stuff.
Sure. So we're attacking the age-old problem of the ulcers and bleeding that you get from common everyday painkillers. I bet the two of you take them. I do from time to time, along with 90% of Americans. These are the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs: aspirin, Advil, Proxyn, Aleve, Motrin. You know, it just goes on and on. They've been around for 50 years. Aspirin's been around for 100 years. For the full 50 years, it's been known that they cause ulcers and bleeding in the stomach and the intestines in about 25% of people. And it's been incredibly a hard problem to solve. But there are no good alternatives. The opioids, which have their own problems. So that's why doctors prescribe them every day. And so many people take them. And, 90% of Americans, 2 billion people around the world. And then they monitor you. Your lovely congresswoman, of course, Debbie Dingell, just had an issue, just bringing it right to the fore. We think we have solved that. And it's actually quite fascinating, this age-old problem. I mean, if you can solve this problem, you'll sell $30 billion, $30 billion with a B for Bob. And that's actually well known. So everyone and their uncle have taken a run at this problem over the past 30 years, including almost all of major pharma. And came up with drugs such as, like Celebrex and Vioxx, for example. These drugs were a bit better on the stomach intestines, but they were killing you for heart reasons. And so most of them were withdrawn. Not a good thing. Celebrex never was, became quite, continues to be a large money maker. But in 2008, the American Heart Association came out with a strong recommendation that doctors start with naproxen, which is now the dominant NSAID in the United States for osteoarthritis. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, my college roommate, who would have thought, this smart, funny guy in the 70s, he's a superstar. And your readers would see that in 10 seconds of due diligence. You just Google it. John did his postdoctorate in the 80s for John Vane. John Vane is better known as Sir John Vane, and Nobel Prize winner for discovering how aspirin works. No one knew. And 10 years later, my John is credited with discovering how these drugs cause the ulcers and bleeding. Just a huge discovery, and there's a whole body of work there, and he's gone on to be a superstar in the field. And then very interestingly, 10 years, it's neat. And then 10 years later, John made another major discovery, namely that hydrogen sulfide is the body's key mediator or manager of inflammation. He did that around 2002. Huge. You know, how John came to be working with hydrogen sulfide is through his and our longtime association with Lou Ignaro from UCLA. Lou himself has the Nobel Prize in Medicine for 1998 for his work with what are now called the gaseous mediators. So nitric oxide, hydrogen sulfide, they both come out of smokestacks, and carbon monoxide comes out of the exhaust pipe of your pickup truck. I mean, who would have thought these things are known for 100 years as poisonous gases, but at the individual molecule level, they play key roles in our body. Hence, they're signaling molecules. They carry an electrical signal across the cell wall or across the synapse. And just fascinating. And of course, it wins the Nobel Prize.
So how do you figure that out? How do you even get to that point? Like, you just, I think I'll just try injecting some hydrogen sulfide into this little creature and see if it repairs some intestinal damage. I assume it's more than that, but
it's a bit more than that. But fundamentally, the thing that that eases the inflammatory pain is the same thing that causes the ulcers and bleeding. That's why it's been such a hard problem to solve. And so all these people who put buffered coatings on it or extended, it doesn't work. It's right. That's why it's been so hard to solve. And so. So when John just, he's a base scientist, he works with mice and test tubes. And when John discovered that hydrogen sulfide is, there really was an aha moment, quite like the light bulb going on. He saw that in the blood vessel, and we have a movie, it's fascinating. You see the blood flowing along this venule. Yeah, the venule in the intestine of a rat. And then every now and then you see these white little globs sticking like Velcro to the blood vessel wall. Those are neutrophils, these blood components. And that sticking, that Velcro-like action, is the first part of the inflammatory cascade. And then those things migrate into the tissue and cause all this inflammation. And John realized, because he can halt the natural production of hydrogen sulfide, John realized that, oh my gosh, if I stop that, these proliferate. The Velcro action really increases, and it's hydrogen sulfide that prevents that. And so John then had this brainstorm idea, very simple. And he said, you know, what happens if I took a molecule, namely a drug, and I attach to it another molecule that will release hydrogen sulfide? And the combined molecule, you know, it will be a new molecule. I can get a new patent for that. And so John made, three chemists, made dozens of these, dozens of donors, and then dozens of NSAIDs. And so we have a lot of these, and we're bringing three to market. It's not easy to do, and it took years. And and then we chose, of course, the best ones. And so atenoproxacil is essentially a molecule that releases hydrogen sulfide attached to the naproxen molecule. It acts like a new molecule, albeit exhibiting characteristics of naproxen, which is the main NSAID in the United States. And the results have been, the results, as you can see, have been phenomenal. We have more published work in academic journals. This is not your Friday night reading, let me tell you. But we have more published work than Merck or Pfizer or anyone. That's, it's because John has been doing this for 30 years and with our drugs for 15. But we really do have an abundance of data, including in all the difficult stuff where you take animals and you use diseased animals or animals that have some sort of compromised defensive systems and NSAIDs. You know, if you give them an NSAID, the bad damage will triple, whereas with our drugs, it will remain safe. And now we've shown this in our large phase 2B study with 250 people. So you know, for a boring problem of ulcers and bleeding in the stomach and the intestines, it's pretty exciting. We are very excited.
That doesn't sound boring to me, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like a real problem. Yeah. God, why did it take so long to, if you said 2002, that's when he kind of made this discovery. Why does it take so long to get something developed like that?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of years of pure science, and then John is also an expert in inflammatory bowel disease, and we worked on inflammatory bowel disease, and then when the 2008, and then we were working on the NSAIDs. So when the 2008 financial meltdown happened, we were going to do all of our various drugs. We're working a whole series of diseases. We were going to do them all simultaneously. And after the 2008 financial meltdown, we said, let's just concentrate on our best ones, and which happened to be also the largest market. And they were the most recent from a patent light, right, which were the NSAIDs. So we really started from scratch in 2009. Nonetheless, it takes a long, long time to develop drugs. You know, we're 50 years later than thalidomide. And that's why it's pretty amazing for the whole world to come up with these vaccines so fast. But normal drugs take 15 years or so.
Yeah, that's the 1962 amendment. I can't remember the actual name of it, right? What was the name of the drug? The thermodide?
Thalidomide.
Thalidomide.
Thalidomide. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, it caused all the birth defects.
Yes, correct.
Yes. I can't understand how anything ever gets done the way that regulation is written. I mean, it went from like 2 years to develop something to 14 after that, or 15, I think.
Yes, it's a strange business model. You know, you can be worth $1 billion. Most analysts think that that's what we should be worth. You can be worth $1 billion and still be several years from revenue. It's just right. You know, it's a rather, from a retail investment point of view, it's a challenging field. It's not like software.
Yeah.
It's wildly more complicated.
Well, you need investors that are going to be in it for the long haul too, because they have to wait through a long development period. It sounds like you guys are getting really close, though. You finished your phase two. It looked like you guys got approval to, I'm not sure if that's plan your phase three. I think you're able to submit the plan for that, or you're planning
We received our IND from the FDA in the United States, and that essentially that means we can do clinical trials in the United States. We have a small one going on right now, a small study of volunteers, a scientific study, as we're getting ready for our phase threes. We only filed our IND in the United States recently because we did all of our work. We've already done five or six clinical trials in hundreds of people. We did it in Canada. So guess how many pages, here's a fun fact for you. Guess how many pages are IND application was to the FDA?
702.
And Dan?
703. 1,500 pages?
I asked my daughter to guess this when she was doing a major paper for her third year at university. She said 300. 55,000.
Oh, my God.
What? 55,000 pages?
Take you 2 years to write that.
Oh, okay. It was a whole team of us. It's amazing. It's interesting.
So FDA approval gets you licensed in America. Does Canada reciprocate that, or can you get licensed in other countries? Like, is it, if you get FDA approval here, are you good to sell anywhere else, or do you have to go through the approval process everywhere?
You have to go through the approval process everywhere.
Oh my gosh.
However, it's infinitely easier. First of all, there is a lot of harmonization, through diplomacy over the decades. Mm-hmm. All the Western world countries certainly have sort of more landed together, and they provide a lot of respect for studies done elsewhere. And this is particularly so with the FDA. The FDA is clearly the premier agency. The next important one is Europe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for example, if we were approved in the United States, it would not be difficult to get approved in Canada.
Okay, so you wouldn't have to basically start from scratch. No, then you could at least use some of that other work, it sounds like.
You all of it. We would not have to do any more scientific work. For Europe, we'd have to do an extra study. And for Asia, we would have to do smaller extra studies because there are some genetic differences and that sort of thing. But by and large, the world would rely on the U.S. data.
It looks like you partnered with, you developed a licensing agreement with Nuance Pharma. Is part of that for them to do those approval processes throughout China?
Yes, we're thrilled. A great company. It was our fourth deal, actually. Licensed the tenaproxazole for some 50 countries. China was the largest one. And these things help. They give us validation. They give us non-dilutive money. But now we're now in dialogue for the large markets in the big five in Europe and the United States, of course, and Japan. But we were very, very pleased with the Chinese deal. First of all, the terms were quite attractive that we received. It sort of raised the eyebrows of the industry because we negotiated quite nice terms. And they're a great company. Their CEO more or less built the commercial franchise for AstraZeneca. He's a South African, but deeply knows the Chinese commercial landscape, which is rapidly evolving, actually. And we received a really nice money. Plus, we have essentially a veto. It's quite a friendly partnership, but they want and respect our involvement in their clinical trial process. We'll have to do a phase 3 trial in China.
Mm-hmm. Do you worry at all about intellectual property theft? I think China is kind of known for that.
Yes, you do. Less so in the pharmaceutical world because our recipe is on the internet and you can get it in 2 hours. It's just that you can't sell it. So it just takes years. And China wants to sell drugs to the rest of the world. Their industry is becoming very, very sophisticated. And so this is not going to help them from a reputation point of view. But Nuance is very Western oriented. All their senior team have extensive Western company experience. So the concerns are legitimate that you're talking about, but they're minimized with the case of Nuance.
Gotcha. Dan, I think you started to ask a question about 4 or 5 minutes ago.
So these drugs, are they going to be over the counter when they make it to market, assuming they make it to market?
Eventually, over the counter drugs start out as prescription drugs. So then you need more extensive studies to bring them over the counter. So naproxen, as I mentioned, which is the dominant NSAID for osteoarthritis, for example, in the United States, took years, but then became at half the standard prescription dose, became Aleve, an over-the-counter drug. And Aleve is only, it was only just a short number of years ago that it was approved for over-the-counter in Canada. So eventually, but the prescription market is massive, just from a prescription point of view.
Yes.
Should we get to market, the big, there's still risk. Should we get to market just in the five main countries of Europe, Japan and the United States, and just in those seven countries, and just for osteoarthritis, let alone low back pain and everything else. We've done extensive commercial studies. These were done by well-known strategy consultancies. you know, just in those seven countries and just for osteoarthritis, we would likely sell over $4 billion a year of prescription drug just in those seven countries at our peak year of sales. So, I mean, we're focused on the prescription market. We would be long gone, before a large pharma took our drug over the counter.
So, yeah, speaking of, we'd be long gone by that time. There was some buzz on the online communities wondering about the depth of your scientific and research team, and like, do you have a succession plan? Because like Dr. John Wallace seems to be a guru, amazing genius scientist man, and people worry like, what if he got in a car wreck tomorrow? What would happen to the company?
Also, that question is from Louise. So thank you, Louise, for submitting that.
Yes. Thank you, Louise.
John was my college roommate, as I mentioned 40 years ago. So we've been friends for a long, long time. And so John, be not willing, since we got hit by the proverbial bus. Oh, I don't think we would.
Yeah.
We wouldn't really skip a beat because he's a base scientist, and we're so far beyond that with our lead drug. Because it's all regulatory development, but for our newer discoveries, which are very keen on, but you know they take time. John's hugely valuable. And as a matter of fact, at Christmas time, I wrote an internal memo. I called it Christmas Thoughts. And because of John's discovery in hydrogen sulfide and our knowledge now that hydrogen sulfide plays so many roles, not only the main in inflammation, but also in cellular repair and cellular protection. I mean, it's now known, it wasn't known when John was in all this, it's now known that every cell in our body makes hydrogen sulfide. Every cell in our body, most of it in the brain, so do the bacteria. Hydrogen sulfide makes ATP, poor Miss Barry, my lovely high school biology teacher, would turn over in her grave, because we were taught that oxygen is needed, but hydrogen sulfide also makes the fundamental unit of energy in a cell. And
really?
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, you know, when life was forming on our planet some 2.6 billion years ago, there was no oxygen. It was all hydrogen sulfide.
Wow.
And so a lot of scientists think that's why it's so important. Oxygen didn't show up until 2 billion years later. Oxygen had only been around for 600 million years in our atmosphere. I mean, just fascinating. So we want to move beyond the gut into all sorts of things. This is our long range, and we're mighty focused on etanoprax-azole, of course, because that's where the vast majority of our value is. But we love this, and so we want to move beyond. And so the strategy, I called it, we need more baby Johns. So when John was doing all this work, he was about 38 years old, in that magical time from 32 to 48, he was just pumped through an enormous amount of stuff. But we're very interested in respiratory illnesses and Alzheimer's and the cardiology and anti-infectives, that sort of thing. And each of these needs, that 35-year-old John Wallace. But we know so many people, and so we're actively in dialogue on those things. And they don't have to work full-time for us. They can be academic professors,
Does the hydrogen sulfide show any promise in those regards, or are you still just looking at the basic levels at this point as far as, like, Alzheimer's and that?
Oh, it shows huge promise. I mean, we've long predicted that they're going to find the link to Alzheimer's. I mean, whatever the hell Alzheimer's is, are all these tangles, is that the result or is that the cause? I mean, you just know that inflammation is at the cause of it. And observationally, 5 years ago, it was observed that Alzheimer's patients have markedly less endogenous. Endogenous means, naturally producing, much less natural production of hydrogen sulfide. And sure enough, just after Christmas, Johns Hopkins put out a paper showing the link to hydrogen sulfide. So, I would bet you a beer that in my lifetime, Alzheimer's is going to get, solved by some sort of medication involving hydrogen sulfide.
I hope it's quick because my family has a history of it.
Yeah. I'd love to see Antib come out with that drug. My family too.
Yes.
Yeah. Me too. Though it'll take some time, but that's something that we would love to explore.
Yeah.
You mentioned the etanoprax-azole being, or at least the opioids being something that you're looking to replace with your hydrogen sulfide platform. Have you seen any opposition from the opioid industry?
Oh, none.
any smear campaigns or anything like that?
Nothing shady.
Oh, I think we're too tiny for them to. Okay. Besides, they sort of learned their lesson. I mean, no. I think they'd be the first to acknowledge that it's a big enough world out there, and the world definitely needs safer pain medicine.
Yes. For the as far as the phase the different phase trials go, can you explain the difference between like phase 1, phase 2, phase 3?
Absolutely.
Like what are the metrics that we'll start with that, and I'm sure I'll have more as we go.
Sure, absolutely. Let me start even earlier, and I can do it pretty quickly. Generally speaking, you know, after the Second World War, most drugs, almost all the drugs, came from Big Pharma. Mm-hmm. Today, much, much less than 20% of drugs come from Big Pharma. They mostly come from small companies like Ontee. Science is exploding, and one company can't know everything. So the rough general idea is that neat discoveries happen in universities, and then if you can get what is generally called academic proof of concept, meaning they get a discovery, they do all sorts of stuff, and then they put it into animals, and then they like rats, and they went, oh my God, I'm onto something. At that point, usually a company would have been formed. At that point, it can generally attract real money, because at animal proof of concept, you start what is called the IND enabling studies, like the formal studies that you need to do to be able to put a drug into a human being. That's called the IND enabling stage, and then you file for your first human trial, and that is generally called a phase one. You use healthy volunteers, you know, university students or whatever, and almost every drug does a very similar phase one program, and it's just for overall safety. And it's, these things are extremely well controlled, doctors 24/7 and that sort of thing. So, and they're all very similar. So if you do that, then you do phase two. It's usually two or more trials, but essentially, you're trying to show human proof of concept. So now you're actually in patients addressing the issue that for which you've designed the drug. And you're also trying to set the dose for the phase three trials. But the phase two is generally culminates in a human proof of concept. And then you go move on to the phase three trials, which are generally a repeat of the phase two, but in for longer duration and in larger numbers of people. And that's phase three. Mm.
So if you show promise in phase two, I mean, you're not necessarily guaranteed to show the same thing in phase three. What are some of the pitfalls then, or why do you think that is?
Sure. I mean, phase threes used to be particularly risky. The risks have gone down over time, but the numbers of things you have to do prior to that has increased also. Mm-hmm. So today, on average, and you know, on a bell curve, on average, about less than 20%, which is quite still risky, but quite lovely, fewer than 20% fail. The vast majority, sometimes they fail for lack of efficacy, or your proof of concept might not have been all that strong. More likely, you fail for some unknown problem because you're doing much longer duration trial or in larger numbers of people.
So more chances for like side effects to pop up or something that.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. And if you know, that's, you know, we've only been in human beings for 2 weeks, and yet our tenaproxacil would be a chronic medicine, meaning that you can, you know, take it every day for the rest of your lives. So our phase threes, we have to do, you know, the primary phase threes are two, all phase threes need to be two identical trials in different locations. And the primary ones are these pain trials for us in placebo controlled. However, 100 people at the end of the 3-month trial, 100 people will continue for an additional 9 months. The blinding will be broken, so they'll know they're on drug, but they will be monitored. So we will have at least 100 people for a full 12 months. That's a requirement for our drug.
This question comes from the StockTwits community user MH5555. He wanted to know if there is a reason for the staggered phase three versus running concurrently, because he said that in his mind that would increase the or extend the timeline significantly.
Yeah, well, that's a very astute question. The reason for that is our first phase three trial, we're going to do multiple, have two arms of our drug. Our drug has shown more efficacy than we thought it would in the phase twos, and it has given us what, you know, the good problem or the nice problem that we still have not found the lowest effective dose.
Oh.
And in generally, the FDA, certainly in pain drugs, you know, the classic funny line, like, how much drug do you give? Well, you as much as you need, as little as possible. So the FDA will require you to show the lowest effective dose. And so we haven't yet done that. We did three doses in our phase, but all three of the doses showed great efficacy. So we're going to do a two-arm dose. And halfway through, there's a chance that we can then start the next trial. But that'll be at the dose that we discovered to be the lowest effective dose. So that's why it's staggered.
So the problem is you haven't figured out how little you need to be effective. That's a great problem.
Yeah.
He had another question here that I thought was pretty good too. Are you guys exploring other partnerships to advance other HS2 drugs and into trials faster, like leveraging other larger biotech companies to run those trials for you?
Well, we are. We are on the classic, you know, when I described the various phases, from a business point of view, generally speaking, though, of course, there's all of exceptions, but generally speaking, the optimal time to partner is sometime after phase two, while you're doing the phase threes. And that's what we're doing. So we are on the classic parallel track, moving forward as expeditiously as we can. And we have the full team and capability of doing that and money, which is fantastic, to do our phase threes while in parallel, we're now engaged in dialogue with partnering our drug. And so, you know, should we get a good offer, we would, and from a very reputable larger company, we would probably hand over en route and pass the baton and then move on to our other drug.
And you have three of those in the pipeline right now, from what I could see on your website. 352 was one that looked really promising, but that one looked like it hadn't done or is in the middle of phase one. Did I see that right? Or is pre-trials?
It's in pre-trials. They all are. Yeah. We have
pre-trials.
ATB352, ATB340, and we're moving forward again on inflammatory bowel disease. We don't yet have a numbered cant there, though we have 60 molecules that we're actually screening at the moment.
Has anybody submitted Dr. John Wallace for a Nobel Prize yet? Because, I mean, good Lord.
You know, I know you're sort of jesting, but here's a...
No, really. I mean, seriously. Yeah.
Yeah, here's a neat human story. I mean, I'm not a scientist. I'm a lawyer by my previous life. But I was, you know, if you look on our website, you see the science advisory board. And I was at, I was going to, you know, a whole bunch of us, we were actually in London, England, so prior pre-pandemic, but a whole bunch of us were, I wasn't saying much, but I was sort of leading it. You know, we were in a conference room, and we're going to go out for a great dinner because all these people are friends, even though they all live in other sides of the world, brainstorming new potential areas for us to explore. It was just so fascinating. It was great. And it was a brainstorm among people, many of whom have known each other for decades, and all eminent scientists. You can see them all. They're on our website. And, you know, just from a body language point of view, the deference shown John was fascinating, including by a Nobel Prize. A Nobel Prize winner. They really do think of John as the real deal, you know?
It sounds like it. Oh, my goodness. Dan, do we have any other reader questions or questions from the Stock Twits community?
Yeah, we got quite a few. The one I wanted to ask before we mine for another one of those, I noticed there was very recently, within the last couple of days, there was news of an amalgamation transaction.
Yes.
Could you explain to us what that was?
Sure. So in 2004, John, he had now come up with a whole series of candidates, and they're looking very, very promising, and started a company on Teeb. And then he actually Googled me, because we never lived in the same city after after university. It said, I'm on to something. Flew into Toronto, and so we moved this forward. And my plan was, I'm going to put each indication, each family of drugs, into a separate, wholly owned subsidiary company, then finance those subsidiaries separately, because one venture capital company might not be interested in inflammatory bowel disease, but very interested in pain, for example. So I was going to do I was going to do each indication in a separate subsidiary. And that was, but then, as I mentioned earlier in this conversation, with the 2008 financial meltdown, I mean, biotech financing was just decimated.
Done. Yeah.
And I realized I wasn't going to be able to do a whole series of indications simultaneously. That would have been too hard to finance. So I sucked it up and decided to move forward with the drugs that were performing the best. They also happened to have the most recent IP and just a huge market, etanercept and its colleagues, 352 and 340. And so, but to finance that, well, we put it into a wholly owned subsidiary, and then we financed classic friends and family financing, and raised about $7 or $8 million, and then took that company public back in 2013. And so, you know, we have long wanted to bring those two companies together to unify the IP. Now that we're talking to big pharma, ideally they're not going to want to deal with a public company and a private company, and that private company is not a university; it's a company. John and I were the major shareholders of that company, so that company could go bankrupt, whatever. It could get into lawsuits. It's just not an attractive solution for big pharma. So we always wanted to unify the IP, and so we just did a lot of legal and tax analysis and decided that the lawyers decided the best way to do it was by a true formal amalgamation. And it was a huge amount of paperwork. And since John and I in particular were afflicted, we stayed out of it. So each company, the private company and the public company, created independent board committees, each of whom hired lawyers and each of whom hired independent investment banks for fairness opinions. And then it was pretty friendly negotiation because it was pretty easy to understand the license agreement. The license agreement has been filed publicly since 2013. So
how many pages was that document?
About 15. Not like the registration. but in any event, a long involved legal process, but a rather mundane one, you had to have shareholder agreements and you had to have shareholder meetings and that sort of thing. In any event, it finally closed last week, which we're thrilled about.
You know, if I had just come across that news and didn't have this interview and was talking about it on the podcast, I would be saying, look at this fantastic news. If the guys running this company are unifying their IP into one package, they expect big things on the horizon. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Well, we do expect big things. There's always risk, of course. And that is precisely why we did it.
Sure.
Precisely is why we did it, because we're at the stage now where we're in dialogue now. So, we started working on the amalgamation 2 years ago, we're glad it's finished because it's a lot of legal work, but it does make us more valuable in our view.
I would think so. One quick question going back to the Nuance deal, I guess maybe not quick. This was one of my main concerns when I look at stocks that aren't necessarily like big names and they're traded over the counter or are not really all that well known, not bringing in revenue yet. With regards to that Nuance deal, does that alleviate any concerns of equity raises through stock issuances in the near term? One thing that I am always on the lookout is a company that's main source of income is by issuing stock. And it looks like you guys have not done that in a while. With the $20 million that you received from Nuance, I would assume that wouldn't be that much of a concern going forward.
Well, let me correct you on one important fact. A week after the Nuance deal, we did raise money. It was offered to us by one of the large investment banks, and it was what's called a bought deal, so and at a lovely price.
I did see that.
A lovely price, and no risk to us. And so so those two deals in the course of a week in February together gave us a really nice capitalization and put us in a much, much stronger position. So, now we can march forward with our phase threes fully negotiate to partner off our drug and not get pushed around, because the main way that they push you around is by thinking you don't have enough money to continue on your own, and we clearly do.
Right.
So yeah, there are no financing. There's no liquidity concerns, but there's also no dilution concerns going forward. No financings contemplated going forward. Though I would say one thing. I mean, retail investors, you know, hate dilution. I hate dilution. We all hate dilution. Right. But the main form of weakness in a biotech company is not having enough money. Not the other way around. That's how they don't make it. So I would caution against the knee-jerk reaction that, oh gosh, that's more dilution. It's I don't like being diluted because I have, right. but I like having biotech. I like having a strong balance sheet. Biotech takes a huge amount of money to move forward, and you also need to be able to move forward if you're going to partner a drug.
Right. I agree with you 100%. I just get nervous when I see a company that does that, you know, every quarter or every 6 months.
Yeah.
They're issuing another. Yeah. Which I, looking through the financials, I don't see that with the Antib. That's been our Antib.
So. We had over $100 million of demand, mostly American, for the 40 that we, well, I'm thinking in Canadian dollars, for the 40 Canadian that we took in February. Get over $100 million demand, and you know, obviously the investment bankers saying take more because they get a bigger commission. But we thought that was an appropriate and prudent amount. Then we're thrilled that we did that. We will look back and pleased that we made that decision last February.
Mm-hmm. I got one more listener question that I want to get through, because it actually kind of leads in kind of nicely. That seems like he says that you've recently stated that Antib has been well received with institutional investors, but there's not been any evidence of those groups buying yet, as far as like 13F filings or just the volume in general on that stock. He wants to know if those institutions are waiting for anything specific, or if there's been any progress in getting more Canadian institutions to invest. Look like you have a conference coming up too. That looks like it's kind of geared towards that Wednesday. I think I saw.
Well, that just we just like constantly talking to investors.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good question. I mean, first of all, you know, the United States is 10 times the population of Canada, but it's about 50 times the financing. It's the capital market strength. It's unbelievable. There are about 3,000 U.S. institutional investors who will invest in small cap biotech. Mm-hmm. There's a handful in Canada. There's a great article in our national newspaper last summer talking about this exact problem. It's a real problem. And most of the institutions who do invest in small cap biotech in Canada, most of them are shareholders of ours. And if you talk to these institutions in the United States, there's not very many. If you talk to these institutions in the United States, many, many of them won't invest in OTC stock, or they won't invest in a foreign company or a non-NASDAQ stock. That is the number one thing holding us back. And we're planning on going on NASDAQ. We haven't, you know, the financing we did in February gave us the strength to calmly go on NASDAQ, which we think is fine. And we're just waiting for the opportune time. And we want to more or less line it up with the start of our phase threes.
You just answered another question on my list.
Our plans up list is always on the front of our radar screen. We have a very good have a very good reception from the sell side in New York. You know, the investment banks, they would love to take us on the NASDAQ. And we want to do it in a calm, strategic way. And you can't rush onto NASDAQ because, your stock won't trade well often. Afterwards, it's a more serious environment than Canada. And so we're now in strong position to do that. And we're going to do it calmly. And as I mentioned, more or less time it to the beginning of our phase threes.
Are there any hurdles standing in our way as far as uplisting?
No, we have the support of the community there, and so it's just it's a question of strategy and timing.
It's just a timing thing, right?
Yeah, it's a timing thing. We don't want it so soon after raising money, and you don't do anything in this. Well, certainly, right. Canadians don't do anything in the summertime.
I think we got through all of my questions and all the the StockTwit questions. Dan, do you have anything else you want to ask?
There was another question from StockTwits that is of a different caliber, I think. Someone MH5555, or was it you, Kyle?
He asked like six questions.
Why were the BioPub interviews taken down? I'm assuming these were some good interviews you guys did.
Oh, yes. That was my question, actually. Thank you for finding that.
Okay. Well, there you go. That's a question from my co-host, Kyle.
Several of the users on StockTwits have commented on that being a fantastic interview, and actually listened to him several different times.
Yeah, when Mark Swaim interviewed Dr. KSS, as he's called, interviewed me, you mean is that what you're talking about?
I think so. We couldn't find it because they've been gone.
No, I don't know.
I'm assuming this is news to you, Dan.
That sounds like it.
It's news to me. I don't. I love Dr. KSS. I interact with them every few months. I didn't know that they're no longer there. I received a lot of nice comments about it. In one of them, I was at my farm, and it was live. It was live on video on the Zoom complex Zoom thing. And it was a fireside chat, and my golden retriever, my dog, came up and right into the frame of the camera and nudged me to pat him. It was great. It was a great moment. I don't know. I'm sure I'm sure I can get a copy for you.
Oh, that'd be great. I want to close things out, Dan, if you've got nothing else, with just a message from user Serendipity on StockTwits, if that's all right.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. This is a response to the amazing questions that they had written. They said, the bottom line is that many of today's retail investors are very savvy and intelligent. They're hungry for information, and they want to be engaged in what's going on in the companies they invest in. They are doctors, scientists, dentists, and many other professionals invested in Ontib, and most would like more than once or twice a year, see a CEO update or random PR. Ontib has such a great story to share, and these next generation anti-inflammatory anagelistic medications being developed could soon be household names everyone is using and talking about, like Tylenol, Advil, and Aleve today. That's why I'm excited about your interview with Dan, and why I replayed those three BioPub interviews dozens of times. To me, it's more than just the financial ROI. I'm actually part of a company that has the potential to impact people all over the globe, including myself and my family. So again, looking forward to listening to your conversation. Those are the types of investors you have, and I just wanted to share that with you.
Well, I appreciate that. We love those types of investors, and the more they want to know, and the harder the questions. I mean, I just think that's great. Right. I'm going to think about that. We're nice non-promotional Canadians. We don't manufacture news. We right. don't put out a press release unless we have something. But I'll think about maybe more. We do a lot of strategy. We have a lot of work going on at the moment. Doesn't cost very much, but this mm-hmm. early candidate development and a number of things that I was talking about. But so I'll talk to my colleagues, and we'll brainstorm. Perhaps we'll put out a letter from me, like we call it a CEO letter. We're talking about corporate updates more often than we do. I'll take that to heart and really think about it.
Oh, that'd be great. Yes, and you're always welcome to come back here if you've ever got anything new to share.
Oh, that would be a pleasure. This has been very enjoyable.
Pleasure's all on this side. I was going to play a game with you. We usually do one with our guests, but I don't know if a CEO wants to play better with alcohol when I name different drugs. So I think we'll just skip that.
Well, next time. See, I'll look forward to that.
Is Dr. Wallace working on any party drugs at the moment, or is it all just beneficial of mankind drugs?
He's a bit of a party pooper. It's only beneficial to mankind drugs.
Oh, well. All right. Well, that was my last question, Kyle. I got nothing else.
I've got nothing else either. Thank you so much for joining us, Dan.
You're very welcome. Bye now.
Take care. We got to close up the China shop here, folks. I hope you've had a great time. It's just been such a blast having Dan Legault here from Ontib. Really informative stuff. I'm excited about what that company has going in the future. I don't know about Kyle here, but
I've loaded up the stock ticker on my TD Ameritrade. I'm getting ready to buy shares as we speak.
if Ameritrade let me buy shares over the counter after hours, I would have to say during the course of this interview, I became a shareholder.
Yes.
Anyway, we got to wrap up the interview. We hope you come back and join us soon this Saturday for our next exciting episode. We got a lot more interviews coming up this month as well. But until then, happy trades.
Bye, folks. Thanks for joining us. You can find us off air at twobullsinachinashop.com. That's the number 2bullsinachinashop.com. Make sure you check us out. Download us on any streaming network. Blah, 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 blah. You know what to do. Rate, subscribe.
Two Bulls in a China Shop is an entertainment program, and all thoughts and opinions expressed in the show belong to the hosts and not of any company. They are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security or investment product. It is only intended to provide entertainment about stocks and the financial industry of trading. If you make trades based on what you hear in this show, you assume all risks for those trades.